He hated losing more than anything. And so if somebody got an advantage on him, he was known to have something to say. Man, you're playing good today. I hope it holds up. Arnold Palmer gets in your ear like that, but that's still tough to handle. I'll never forget, there was a banker from Pittsburgh, and he had been nothing but annoying, and that's just being nice. Trying to trash talk AP, trying to be something he wasn't. So he had been hooking the ball a little bit and said something to me about, I can't get out of this hook, man. I got to get out of this hook. And I said, we'll help you afterwards. Well, finally, Mr. Palmer just walked over, grabbed a hold of his driver and gave it a little creak and handed it back to him. And it went from closed to open. And he hands it to him and says, here, hit this. And the guy says, what'd you do to my driver? And he says, I just took the hook out of it. And he hit one and he sliced it way to the right. He goes, now what do I do? And he says, I don't know. You didn't want to hook it. You're not hooking it anymore.
Golf Smarter number 804. Arnold Palmer's 15-plus year playing partner, Bruce Rarick, has incredible stories to share.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Bruce.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us, because you were highly recommended just a few weeks ago by Josh Zander. He said two things. You're an amazing putting instructor, and you have fabulous stories. And I said, sign me up.
Well, I hope I live up to the billing.
Well, we'll tell you at the end.
Okay.
So let's start with stories. I understand you worked with Arnold Palmer for many years.
I did. I started in 1981. I became an assistant at the Bay Hill Club for him there. And then we went to La Trobe in 1986, and I was there till 1996. Then I worked for the design company after that as a, I don't know, rainmaker, I guess is what you would call it, looking for property. And it was the greatest job ever. It just didn't pay very good, but it was, you know, looking for a place to build a golf course. So yeah, it was a great time. That's the only way you could put it. It just was a great, great period of my life.
And you were not just an employee of the company. You had direct contact with Mr. Palmer.
Yeah.
Have to say Mr. Palmer, don't we?
Well, he's Arnie to everybody. Yeah.
Okay.
When I worked at Bay Hill, his office was basically a glass office off the pro shop. So the joke was he looked at the back of my head for 7 years. And then from there at La Trobe, I didn't work for the company. I worked for the family. And so, yeah. And so, like, for example, I did talking about playing golf with him, and he would, the first week I was there at La Trobe, when I went up there, he called and he said, hey, Bruce, I'm in town. Could you make a game for me? Well, Mr. Palmer, I really don't know who you play with up here. You know, I'm just coming up from Florida. And he said, well, just call the guys that you know that come to Bay Hill and we'll figure it out. So I called and got two other guys. And so I called him and I said, hey, boss, nobody knew you're home. Only got three. And he said, well, what are you doing today? And I said, well, anything I'm doing, I can do when it's dark. And he said, all right, so why don't you come play? And so the next day he called and he said, same thing. You know, I'm here in town. Can you call some guys for me? And So I just called the same two guys, didn't call anybody else. Called him back and took a chance. And he started laughing and he goes, well, you got time? And I said, yeah. And so that turned into, I was the fill-in guy for any golf game while he was home. And my dad used to keep track. He made me call him after I get done playing.
And good for him.
It was well over 400 rounds of golf.
Wow.
And
I got to know, when you called these guys and you said, hey, are you available to play golf tomorrow? Did you say with?
Oh, yeah.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, they were all friends.
Oh, okay.
At Bay Hill and La Trobe, there's a group of guys that were Mr. Palmer's friends. And Mr. Palmer, being as big a celebrity as he was still one of the guys. And so it would be no different than you calling and making a game and the only reason I did it was then he didn't hurt anybody's feelings by not calling. If they ever said, hey, Arnie, when are we going to get a game? We said, well, Bruce makes the games. Let him, you know, let him know. And then I could go back and say, hey, P, do you want to play with this guy? And they'd go, yeah, I don't know. Or, yeah, I'd love to. And, you know, and we'd make it happen. So that was the payment that I made to be able to play golf with him, was I had to take the responsibility of making the call. So. Because there's a lot of people that would, you know, their feelings were hurt if they didn't get a chance to play with him. And he tried as hard as he could to play with everybody, at least at the members of the club. If they wanted to play, he'd play. And he didn't care how he played, as long as you tried to keep up.
So yeah. Was he the kind of golf partner that challenged people? You're laughing already. I haven't even finished
Absolutely.
The question.
Absolutely. We had a – there's a picture hanging on my wall, and it's of us on the 17th tee, and we're getting beat. And I'm his partner, and we're getting beat. And so on that hole, we're playing the same two guys we had played all summer, and – he said to the one guy, he said, "Hey, how about a long drive contest for a beer?" Well, he knew that the guy would just swing out of his heels and hit it out of play. And so that was how he got rid of one. He hits it off the planet. And then turned out he holed that out for a two to win that hole. It's kind of a legendary story. He was in the pine trees, said, you know, the other player was in there going to make a birdie. And he asked me, I said, "No, we're in trouble." And you couldn't even see him. And all of a sudden, there's this cloud of dust. And just like John Wayne playing golf, and the ball goes right in the hole for a two, and he birdies the last hole, and we win one up. Wow. And yeah, so it was – I mean, it was great. Greg Norman's plane broke down one time, and he was over Pennsylvania, and he ended up – they landed in Latrobe, and he came out and played three holes with us one afternoon. He played barefoot in a sport shirt. And then it was an all-nighter.
Hey, and the club allowed this?
Yeah, I don't think Greg would mind me telling, but it was about an all-nighter after that. The best part of that day was the story time afterwards. Unbelievable. We had a table in our locker room that 12 people. And so the bunch of us were sitting there after the round of golf, and people kept milling in. And then word got out that Greg was in town. And by the end of the night, there had to be 50 or 60 people in there. And, you know, drinks are flowing and stories are going. And Arnold and Greg right in the middle of it, and just – loving every minute of it. And it just, you know, it's like a moment you never get to replicate, that's for sure. And in fact, it was in Sports Illustrated probably 15 years later. Yeah, part of a story Greg told it. And
did you ever read the book The Match by Mark
Fry? Absolutely. I know it by heart.
Well, it's the same kind of idea where it's absolutely. Like people, the word got out and people started showing up.
Absolutely right. But not anywhere near the level of The Match. And one of the things, one of my connections is that I got to go with Payne Stewart and watch Payne take some lessons from Harvey Ward. And Harvey became a friend. So, you know, Harvey is Venturi's partner in The Match that, you know, and a great guy in his own right, and a million stories there. So, you know, it's just knowing Mr. Palmer has been, you know, what a blessing, because it just, you know, just about everybody in golf somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a lucky opportunity. I was around baseball for a couple of years during the 90s, and I met Warren Spahn a couple of times.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I met Bill Rigney a couple of times. And you could put these two guys in a room, and they would tell stories for days and never repeat one. These baseball stories. And I can imagine having Arnold Palmer and Greg Norman in the same room Arnold Palmer and anybody who's ever played on the tour.
I think the when you go that route, but Whitey Ford was a friend of Mr. Palmer's back in, and he came to Bay Hill one time, and that was another all-nighter in the locker room. I didn't get to participate in that one, but that was legendary. Whitey got going. He didn't stop for 7 hours. He told Yankee stories forever.
From when the Yankees were
the Yankees, that's right.
Yeah, now they're the Spankies, but
yeah.
Sorry, New Yorkers, your team is terrible.
You'll come back. But yeah, it was a treat. It was a real treat, and I'm very quick to tell everybody that everything that I've learned all started from what Mr. Palmer told me, and I think what's fun is it's applicable. I get lately the reputation's been, well, I only talk to or work with, you know, higher echelon players. That's not true at all. And the things that we do I think beneficial to any level, you know, if you're just starting out. And, you know, and putting is always, everybody says, well, I'm a good putter. Well, they just do putting better than they do their full swing, right? It's the best thing that they do. They're not really all that good. And so you can get better. That's the one thing, is there's no physical limitations. You can get better. And, you know, and so Mr. Palmer was a great one for, we used to practice. Mondays was practice day. And we would just, there's no cell phones then. So we would just load up a bunch of clubs and a couple carts, and we'd drive down to the tee, and we just camp out for the day. And through the day, they would bring us lunch and phone messages and, you know, you got to take care of this. I'll do it tomorrow. And, you know, and just we'd go through it. And at the end of the day, he would start hitting putts, and he'd have a bag full of putters. He didn't just have one or two. He had 12 or 20, or depending on how he was feeling about his putting stroke. He kept doing it. So he would hit putts. I'd retrieve the ball and throw it back at him. Well, what was interesting about it is every time he changed putters, he would change his putting stroke. Wow. And I finally asked him, I said, boss, he said, you did a different stroke, different style of stroke for every putter, huh? And he said, yeah. He says, this one works for this one, and this one works for this one, and I got to do this with this one. And I'm just looking for what feels best to me today. Well, that stuck with me. That stuck with me. And so then years later, when I had a chance to meet some people that were selling some technology called Putt Lab, and I went to work for them, I was telling them that story. And I was saying that this would be so cool back then, because we would see exactly what he was doing different with every putter. And well, after 15 years of research, turns out that everything he told me played out. That we see tendencies depending on in your stroke, depending on the putter that you use. And then is that a natural movement for you, or is that something you just artificially create to try and match your perception or what you do or what the putter feels like when you do it? And the basics is, you know, some people think they're straight back and straight through. Some people think they swing it on an arc. Truth of the matter is you do both and you do neither. And so, you know, so having a putter that's balanced to whatever you do, however you move and whatever you do, is very helpful. And, you know, in having a consistent stroke and having a consistent movement pattern. And so like what Josh and I were doing is I'm on a FaceTime and Josh is there and we're basically fitting a person on a putter in real time and not digitally. And that's all we're doing is we're trying to match putters to how the player swings the putter. Nothing fancy about it. And it's, you know, and it's, I shouldn't say this, but it's, I don't know who's your sponsor, Fred, but it's the idea of putter fitting has become this convoluted marketing scheme a little bit, instead of what do you do and what do you need, you know, and then you're limited to whatever the manufacturers offer. So it's, I get a lot of calls about how do I figure out what the best putter for me is? And I always tell them, if you don't have any other assets, just go and start hitting a bunch of putts with different putters till they go in. And then you know which one you got.
All right, we're going to take a time out. I have so many questions based on just the last 3 minutes. No. And we'll do that when we come back after this. This week on Golf Smarter Mulligans, episode 120, we go into the sports medicine studio of Ann Grassel as she takes a once-over of my body, my swing, and what needs to be corrected. It's the first of two episodes with Ann as she answers listener questions about golf fitness in part two. This is another interesting conversation with someone whose website is no longer active, but the information is still fresh.
The golf swing's very complicated. There's a lot of components to it. So one of the things that I teach people when I work with them and teach their bodies to be much more effective in their golf swing is how you set up. How do you engage core? How do you maintain core? How do you rotate from core? If you have those components lined up every time, then you're going to be able to have less of a tendency to get injured. But what I see with people is they do sway or they slide, they do early extension, they're trying to hit the ball hard, they're opening, they don't have their legs positioned well, they're in a C curve or an S curve. These are all different golf swing faults. But it's basically their body's inability to stay engaged in the midline so that they can rotate around that midline and get the different body parts to sequence the way it's supposed to. So what'll happen is that people can't turn, so they'll lift up, which puts more pressure on the neck and the shoulders. Or they can't get their wrists to cock at the top because they're in the wrong position, so they'll just try to push their wrists up more. And these things can all cause injuries.
That's Ann Grassel this week on episode 120 of Golf Smarter Mulligans, being released this Friday. Both Golf Smarter and Golf Smarter Mulligans are available where you're listening to this podcast right now. Please subscribe and follow both so that you can get the brand new episode of either as it downloads to your favorite listening device. You just kind of like dropped this in earlier. You said one of the things that Arnold Palmer told me, what did he tell you? I mean, like, so we talked about him being like competitive, even on friendly matches and, you know, getting in people's heads, I'm sure. Right. But did he ever give instruction? Did he ever help people on the golf course, or did you just let them do their thing?
No, when we would play with, well, I shouldn't say that, but no, he wasn't an instructor, but he loved to talk about golf clubs, and he loved to talk about just how everybody always asked him, why so many clubs? Why do you tinker so much? Why do you keep changing clubs? And he said that because I know what I'm looking for. And he said, most people don't. They just change because they want to change. But I know what I'm looking for. And so for the average person, he wasn't an instructor. It was always just go ask Bruce. And if you got a question, just go ask Bruce. And the great thing was, though, that he would share with me. And so I would ask him about, you know, Mr. Palmer, like, for example, one day the Monday conversations, I call them. One day the conversation went with some of the beats, right? Some of the bad days, what happened, and you know, and some he just didn't want to talk about. Being a Northern California fella, he hated talking about Olympic in 66. He hated talking about that. Billy Casper beating, you know, he had quite a large lead, thinking about breaking the Hogan's record, lost the feel for it, and Casper played brilliantly and came back and caught him. So he didn't really like talking about that one because he was embarrassed that he was thinking about breaking the record, not winning the tournament. That bothered him. But he talked about 61 Masters. He had a one-shot lead standing in the middle of 18 fairway. And someone from the gallery, and there's a large group of people that want to say it was them, but, you know, and some people say it was George Lowe, the putting wizard. Some people say it was a friend of his from La Trobe, which I believe was true. And he went over and he congratulated Mr. Palmer. Mr. Palmer walked over and shook his hand and walked back to the ball and said, you know, Bruce, I forgot how to play golf walking back to the ball. And he says, I was thinking about putting the jacket on myself, you know, I'm a two-time winner in a row and all that stuff. And he shanked it in the bunker. Then he shanked it across the green. Then he chipped it back to about 7-8 feet, missed the putt, double bogey. Here you go, Gary. Congratulations. I'll put the jacket on you. Gary Player ended up winning. And so I said, how did you ever get around that? Because I said, you got distracted every day. There's great footage of him in that following British Open of just being mobbed, not even be able to get out of the mob to walk down the fairway on the 18th hole. And kind of like Phil at the PGA this year. He said, I taught myself how to tell myself how to swing golf clubs. He says, if I swing my left arm back first and I turn my right hip, I can turn my shoulders to the top of my swing, and then I can swing my knees first and then my hands to the ball. So it goes left arm back, right hip clears, turn to the top, knees to the target, hands to the ball. And that little ditty, whatever you want to call it, my daughter put music to it. That little phrase or saying was something that he used then to bring him back to life. So get back in the game, you know, and it was a little different every time. But he knew the sequence of his golf swing so he could get the sequence back so he could get back to hitting the ball. And so things like that, just this, the stuff, how do you get through an event? How do you approach certain shots? How do you keep yourself from getting too gunned up or too down, or, you know, and everybody goes through it. It doesn't matter if you're playing the Masters or you're playing in the league, you know, you still get revved up and you get fired up, and then, you know, it crashes and you go through all that. So I think it's helpful for everybody. I don't think you have to be playing in the Masters to use that kind of stuff.
No, absolutely not. Why do you think this podcast is called Golf Smarter?
That's right. So he would share all that. all that about, you know.
Did you find him to be, in your rounds with him, not what we all watched his years of playing, but did you find him to be highly mechanical, technical player, or was he more a strategic golfer, just playing with what the golf course presented to him?
He was a lot more strategic than he ever got credit for. When he passed, they found a book that I knew of the book, but I'd never seen it. And in that book was the way to play Augusta, his way to play Augusta, and a strategy for playing it every hole. And so if you can imagine, Mr. Palmer wasn't one to hit a high ball or anything left or right. It was always low and draw. So he found a way to get around the golf course with a low hook. So for your listeners, Fred, if all I hit is a high slice, you can still play. You just have to start to slice in the right direction, right? Instead of saying that's a bad shot and trying to change it and ruining the rest of your round by trying to change it, just go ahead and play it. And then go try and fix it later on. Go talk to a pro or something, get some help. And say, I don't want to hit that high slice anymore. I'd rather hit it a little straighter, but don't fight it. Use it. His favorite saying, he loved to tell his customers this. He'd say, there's no such thing as a bad shot. It was just timed poorly. And what he meant by that is if you roll one off the tee, remember how you did it, because you might get stuck in the woods sometimes and rolling one along the ground might be very beneficial. Wow. Or a big snap hook, right? Hit a big snap hook. Well, remember how you did that, because you might play a hole sometime where you have to hit that shot. And so instead of being negative, like, oh, I hit a bad shot, I'm terrible, I get it. No. I just hit it at the wrong time. I'll put that one in the archives. I'll use it later.
Yeah. That's
a great way to, it's a great way to think about playing golf. First of all, it's a lot more fun. You know, it's a lot more fun. But there isn't a shot that you can hit that you won't use at some point.
Sure. Sure.
It just depends on the circumstances.
One of the mantras that's come out of this show and that was fed back to me when we did episode 800 is something that I learned from a listener years ago. And he says, his dad told him this growing up, never follow a bad shot with a stupid shot.
There you go. Exactly. Exactly. You know, you get mad or angry, you know, and you do something that, all right, I've hit it in the woods. Let's try and hit it again. And we see it every week on TV, the guys that follow something up with something worse, you know. How does a player of any kind of talent, you know, make a quad or make a triple? Well, it's because you make a bad decision in there somewhere along the way. So
it's the strategy. Right. It's not your golf swing. It's not the mechanics, right?
Well, you don't have to hit it as good as you think to play well. You don't.
Well, I really just found, and I'll put a link to this article in today's show notes, but I found an article that you wrote probably back in 2016, Thoughts on Golf-Specific Technology. Oh. Do you remember this piece?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but what you talked about, and it just rang so loudly to me that it's like golf mechanics versus playing golf. That building a swing for an optimal situation, or are you building a swing for all situations?
Right. So we go into a fitting, right? And they've got whatever technology that they're using. And they start right away. They start talking to you about optimal numbers. Well, my favorite, if they don't know who I am and I'm listening to something like this, and I'll say, I've got a 9 iron in my hand and I've got 137 yards with the wind out of the right and a bunker in front of me. Can you tell me what the optimal numbers are for that shot? No, I have no clue. So what are we doing? You know, what are we doing? Because I'll have that shot or something like it 40 times in a round, right? So the problem with the optimal numbers is that all that does is say the ball will fly a little bit further if you do this. That's all they're saying. And so I just had a situation the other day where one of my clients is having some ball striking issues, and he is a left to right player. And all of a sudden he's decided to go right to left because the technology told him that his numbers were better based on their standard if he hit a hook. Well, he's scratch plus player shooting 80. And he said, well, my numbers are better if I hit a hook. And I said, no, your numbers are worse. You're shooting 80.
Yeah.
You know, the number that counts is you're shooting 80. So you got to be careful. It's fun. Nothing's more fun than getting in there and finding out what you do and what you don't do and the whole thing. But it doesn't define the game. Nothing does. The putting technology that I grew up, you know, and was part of early on, it doesn't define you as a putter or a putting stroke. If you match, if you you can have a perfect stroke that is the face perfectly square, Fred, with the path exactly on the line that you're starting it on, and you still won't make a putt because you didn't read it correctly or you didn't hit it the right speed or whatever else that goes into it. So you don't want to fall in love with those numbers and think that that's what's making you better. You know, and you don't have to do that. And really, sometimes I think you're better off not. The guys that I respect as teachers, they know how to use it. They know how to utilize the numbers to share with a player. See, here we're making some improvement, or here we're doing what you wanted to do with your golf swing. Not it's not math. It's not a dog show where the best of the breed wins. You know, the best looking swing doesn't win. You know, it doesn't score well and it doesn't win.
No. Parity in golf is there's no other sport has parity like
well, and golf. Thank goodness for these young guys like Matt Wolf and the guys with the more unusual looks to their swing now. And they make it work, right? And people are understanding. For years, Mr. Palmer did a commercial where he said, you know, swing your swing. Oh, he got ridiculed something awful in my world as instructor because, oh, he's not doing the right method and all this. Well, it's great that that's coming back. It's coming back that, yeah, figure out how you do it. You know, get some help to figure out how you do it. And it's a better way. It's a better way to play and a better way to learn.
My son plays golf, and I think he has a really nice golf swing, except he struggles with his scoring. And I've come to realize that it's like, well, you can hit the ball far and you can hit it okay, but I don't think you know how to play a golf course. And he goes, be quiet. Don't tell me that. And I said, well, once you learn how to play a golf course from green to tee, you're going to be a much better golfer.
Totally, totally fair. Right, exactly right. I think a lot of kids are there's a line I used, one of Mr. Palmer's. He told me one time, and I wrote it down, I mean, within minutes on a scorecard of what I'm saying. He said, Bruce, you learned how to hit a golf ball when you're a kid. And I'm 28 years old at the time. You learned how to hit a golf ball as a kid. You hit it beautifully, but you haven't learned how to play yet. And it was totally true. You know, there's stupid shots and there's levels of stupid shots. It just depends on how good a ball striker you are. And I've hit a lot of stupid shots, you know, just dumb stuff, aiming at the wrong spot or challenge a pin or, you know, try and curve it around a tree when I hadn't curved one like that in 4 months, you know, and what are you doing?
Oh, but you saw it on TV.
That's
so
right.
I can do it.
I'm supposed to hit, right?
Right. And if you ever practice it, no, but I saw them do it on TV. Oh, come on, really?
We had a discussion with a guy one time. I won't call it an argument, but it was getting there. Where the guy was telling, he was giving some advice about that you have to visualize every shot. It was one of those mental coaching things, and you visualize every shot. And I jumped in and said, really does no good to visualize a shot that you don't have the talent to hit. Mm. And so if you slice every shot and you're trying to visualize a hook, your brain's got no idea what to do with that. It's just going, what is this? What movie is this? We didn't see this movie, you know? And so you want to cut yourself a break a little bit and just say, what, you know, Mr. Palmer's idea was, I had this conversation this morning, so forgive me for throwing it out there, but his idea was, I get on the tee and I see what I got in inventory. Basically, I've got this shot. I'm hitting the driver this way. I can hit these irons. I'm you know, ball's moving a little bit this way. And then he would take what he thought he had that day, and he would go and play with it. He wouldn't add anything to it. He wouldn't try anything that he didn't think he could hit. He would just go and play. And so, you know, and then he was always going to putt the same. He was always going to be an aggressive minimalist, I call it, green reader, play as little break as possible and hit it as hard as possible, and you know, and then go from there. Well, greens are a little faster now than they were when he was growing up, so you really can't use that, but you can be a little bit that way. And so, you know, and that's just fun to see what that adds up to at the end of the day. And sometimes you surprise yourself. Oh, this was the best round I had in a long time and I didn't do anything different, you know.
All right, let's take another time out. We'll be right back.
We'll get the putting here sometime soon.
Maybe. I don't remember who said it on the show, but they did say to me once on the show years ago, when Tiger was in his prime, that Tiger has no ego. And I'm like, wait, what? Wow. After what we've seen in his life, he has no ego? He says, no, I mean on the golf course. Tiger will never hit a shot that he hasn't tried 1,000 times.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. I'm not sure Mr. Palmer falls quite into that mode. And we're talking about Arnold, because AP was just, he was willing to give it a go. You know, if he was in a spot, he didn't hold back. Tiger and Jack played, Mr. Nicklaus played similarly, where they played the percentages and they played the smart shots. Mr. Palmer was a little more robust than that. He would play strategically in that he knew where he had to be to be the most aggressive. And if it meant coming out of the rough or whatever it meant, he would fit in better today, I think, you know, the way that kids play today, where just real aggressive off the tee. Then, you know, make sure I'm on the right side of the fairway to still be aggressive. And yeah, he was, but I, the idea of no ego, that, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. For him too. Cause he wouldn't brag about anything. He would just say, I'm out here playing, let's go, you know, and it wasn't about, I'm Arnold Palmer, I can do this. Never.
Right. Right. Do you ever have a chance to witness Jack play with Mr. Palmer?
A few times.
Really?
82. There's a story there. 1982 on a Saturday night, I'm running the concession tent at Bay Hill. And in fact, one of the guys that worked with, we worked together, he works here at the fort with me now. 30 years later, we're working together here.
Wow.
But Jack walks by, and Angelo Angie was with him, the caddy with the big gray hair. He goes, Angie, I'll meet you out on the practice tee. We're going to find a swing to win this thing. Well, I heard that, immediately closed down the concession tent, and I went out there to watch him hit balls. And so I got to stand there. It's just the three of us standing out there, and I'm watching. Angie turns to me and he says, you see anything? You work here, right? I said, yeah, I see him just ripping it. What do you want from me? You know, what's going on? He said, well, ball won't move. And so everything's left. He's not hitting his cut. Everything's left. And finally, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure what he did exactly. I got an idea, but I'm not sure exactly what he did. All of a sudden, ball started falling to the right a little bit. That's good. Pack up the clubs and go in. And he got beat in a playoff the next day. Tom Kite chipped in on the first playoff hole to beat him. But, and then he came up to, we did a fundraiser every year for the hospital. Mr. Palmer would invite three friends, and then we'd have a shotgun, event in the morning. And then that was the gallery for the afternoon. So it was really a fun event. And Mr. Nicklaus came and played then, came up and played. They played at our place, I guess. Normally Laurel Valley. We split. I can't remember the two, but yeah, I had a chance to talk to him and see him hit balls then. I watched him. I probably watched him hit more balls than, you know, anybody else, either on TV or video or, you know, whatever it is. I've been a big fan forever. So I was in a tight spot. I swung like him and I worked for Mr. Palmer. So AP would always tease me. He says, you swing just like Jack. And I said, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And he says, well, I think it's a good thing for you. Oh, good. I'm not sure what that means, but I'll go with it, you know?
Was he funny? Was he a funny Palmer? Person to be around?
Yeah. Yeah, dry, but hilarious. Yeah. He was just one of the guys. I mean, he literally was one of the guys. And once you got used to that, once you knew there weren't any boundaries, really, but you would, out of respect, you just didn't. You know, I didn't criticize his golf game or criticize anything he did or anything like that. It wasn't like that. But it was – but oh, no, just really funny. Really funny. And, you know, especially he and I were partners a lot because we didn't want to be in a situation where we had to pay each other if we were playing for something. So if we were teammates then – and so everybody understood that. Well, that's the greatest gig ever. I love that. You know, I got a Hall of Famer for a partner against you knuckleheads. I'm good. Let's go. but people would ask for shots and he'd say stuff like, hey, whatever, you know, whatever makes you happy, you know, he kind of guilt you into it. And But then he never went less than scratch. So you had to do some quick math to figure out what he really was, which was about a plus six at Latrobe. So you had to do some quick math to know if you were going to negotiate to be ready to negotiate. But no, it was great. One of the fun ones was Rocco Media was from that area, and his dad was a barber, owned a beauty salon in town. Every year on Rocco's dad's birthday, the four of us would play. And that was always fun. I mean, we just had such a great time. Laugh all the way around the golf course.
Would he do AP, Mr. Palmer,
yeah. Honey, yeah.
Would he do things on the golf course in these casual rounds, if there was ever such a thing, not competitive rounds, but when you're out with your friends and you invite a couple guys, he's just one of the guys. Right. Did he ever do things to get in people's heads? If they were playing well, would he like mess with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
he didn't need to.
He hated losing more than anything. And so if somebody got an advantage on him, he was known to have something to say about, now, you know, man, you're playing good. You know, you're really playing good today. I hope it holds up. Crash. Arnold Palmer gets in your ear like that. That's still a little tough to handle, right?
And yeah.
I'll never forget there was hopefully he's not listening, but there was a banker from Pittsburgh. And he had been nothing but annoying. And that's just being nice the whole day. Trying to trash talk AP, trying to, you know, just be something he wasn't. And so he had been hooking the ball a little bit and said something to me about, I can't get out of this hook, man. I got to get out of this hook. And I said, well, I'm, you know, my partner, I'm not going to help you with my partner. We'll help you afterwards. And, I got to get rid of this hook, bro. I got to get rid of this hook. Well, finally, Mr. Palmer just walked over, grabbed a hold of his driver, and gave it a little creak and handed it back to him. And it went from closed to open. So it was like our mechanical screw that we put in there and we opened and closed. Mr. Palmer just did it by bending the shaft. And he bent it right in the neck so you wouldn't know. You wouldn't see it bent. It was straight. And then he just bent it right. And he could do that. His hands were just massively strong. And he hands it to him. He says, here, hit this. And the guy says, what'd you do to my driver? And he says,
what did the guys fit? I can't imagine what the guy was like. What are you doing?
Put the hook out of it. And he hit one and he sliced it way to the right. And he goes, now what do I do? And he says, I don't know. You didn't want to hook it. You're not hooking it anymore. So, but that guy had it coming. I'll just say that. And I'm sure he's probably, you know.
Well, he's not listening. I promise.
He had it coming. And hopefully he heard it because he probably – But the truth of the matter is that's what somebody would do. But in the old days was to get rid of a hook was just bend it open a little bit. Just bend it face back and to the right, right at where the whipping is. You could bend it right at that point where the wood met the steel and you could bend them. And so when they came out with the adjustable drivers and everybody's going, oh, this is something brand new. Well, no, it's not. Guys have been doing that forever. You know, all of Hogan's clubs were bent open. All of his clubs. You know, that's how he hit the fade was he just cranked them wide open and then, you know, and then swung hard. And then the face didn't close because the face was wide open when he hit it. He just, you know, just open face and swing left real hard. And the ball goes just a little baby fade.
Oh, man. You know, I can listen to these stories all day long. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to take another quick break.
Okay.
And when we come back from this one, I'm going to bring up putting.
That's good.
We're going to talk about putting because that's what Josh said. Josh told me you got to get Bruce on here because he'll tell you stories and he's an amazing putting coach. So we'll do that.
I'm on a good
run. That after this. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back.
I don't think I've ever told the banker story in public, Fred.
Well, I noticed you didn't say his name.
No, and I didn't say who it was, what company it was.
No, so you just said a banker out of Pittsburgh. And
yeah.
At some point,
if he's around, he'll figure it out. But I don't know. I think he's got to be. We laughed about that forever. I mean, there wasn't a night went by that story didn't come up again. And wow. I'd bring it up because I just thought it was just hilarious. The look
it's
on
a great eyes, story.
It was a Hogan driver, too, and it was a brand new one. Well, there you go. No more slice or no more hook. Hilarious.
Oh, man. I just want to keep hearing stories, but no, let's go. You said something earlier you're not that good at putting. I mean, you think you're a good putter, but that's just because but what is a good, how do we define a good putter?
Well,
and I don't mean the club. I mean the person.
I don't think it's about being good or bad as much as it is that it's okay to have high expectations. Because it's driving me nuts. The idea that, and forgive me guys that are, putting this out there, that the percentages dictate how good a putter you're going to be. I have all these young people coming to me saying, well, Bruce, I make X percentage from 10 feet in. I must be pretty good. I said, no, that's the average. You didn't come to see me to be average. You came to see me to be excellent. The average, the tour, you're using tour averages to say that makes me good. No, the tour guys don't think that's good. You shouldn't think it's good because there's no physical limitations. If you're playing golf, you have the ability to putt just like anybody else. So I think your mindset ought to be that, whatever level you are. But you've got to learn, you have to understand, you have to define yourself. You can't take what's publicized and say that that's going to work for me. That's going to make me better. And the obvious thing is to go buy the latest and greatest putter because it's got this technology that's going to help me putt better, a different shaft or a different face or whatever it is. No, it's going to make you putt different. It's not going to make you putt better. It's going to be different. And then you have to adapt to that. So really it helps if you just understand first, the first thing you need to know is where do I need to stand where my perception of where I'm going is accurate. Now that's not necessarily aim. We do a little test where we put a straight edge down on the ground pointing to a hole, but not direct, not a complete connection, just a straight edge. Yardstick works great. And then I ask the player to address the yardstick like they would address a golf ball. And then standing side on, when you look at what is your perception of where the yardstick's pointed? And they'll say, oh, it's left or it's right or, oh, it looks pretty good. Well, if it looks pretty good, then we know we can go on to plan B. What's the next step? But for a lot of people, especially right eye dominant players, trail eye dominant players, that yardstick will look like it's pointed to the left. And so they'll develop a stroke. I call it putting to the ghost, and the reason is they'll tilt themselves so that their right eye gets the best view. Well, that opens them up to the left. So they look down, everything looks okay when they look down, but when they look up, it looks like the hole's to the right of where they were looking. Okay? So now they think the hole is where it's not really, because when they look back down, now they've got that new view that was pointed right at it, but they have the vision of, oh, it was off to my right. So they go ahead and they push the putter out to the right when they hit it, and they miss it to the right, and they can't figure out why they did. And so we want the visual perception to be accurate. Now, where I got in trouble early on is when I put this out there, I told everybody that your eyes directly over the ball are not necessarily the best place for you to put them because we are not all the same. And what was interesting is I talked to every expert and they'd say, well, yeah, you got to have your eyes over the ball. And well, what if, but not everybody does. And well, everybody's different. That's the next line that comes out of the expert's mouth. If everybody's different, then we got to define it for everybody. We can't just take one definition and apply it to everybody. We have to find out what works for you. So me being right eye dominant with astigmatism, I'm going to stand up to it different than somebody that's left eye dominant that wears glasses or whatever it is. And so then once we find that spot, there's a ball position that matches the best. It's either forward and away from me or close and back or somewhere in between. When we find that, then what we have to do is we have to figure out how we're going to move to get the putter there when it's square, the face is square to the target when I hit it. So that's the mechanical portion. And that's where my relationship with Josh and with Mike Adams and Terry Rolls, these guys have all developed this Mike and Terry have developed this assessment that says these are your physical attributes that contribute to a golf swing, contribute to your putting stroke. I need to know what's the orientation of your trail hand. I need to know, are your arms longer or shorter than your height? And then I can tell you, yes, you should play a longer putter and stand tall, or play a shorter putter and bend over. And because that's what puts you in a balanced posture. And it's exact opposite of whatever everybody thinks it is. If you're tall with long arms, you should play tall with long arms with a longer putter. Because as soon as you start to bend over, now all that weight of your shoulders and your arms and head are pulling you towards your toes, and you have a hard time finding a place to swing. And if your arms are shorter than your height, then those players will typically bend over more. They'll get over the ball more. And it's played out. In theory, it was obvious. It's played out over the last 6 months that we haven't missed one. And when we have moved away from it, we're regretted that we did. And then the final thing then is, once I learn how to move, am I going to use my trail arm? Am I going to use my lead arm? Am I going to rotate my shoulders? Am I going to use my core? Am I going to connect my arms? Am I passive? Or all those things that you've been thinking about anyway, you just didn't use the same words I did to describe them. Then once you decide what you're going to do, then what we need to know is, does the putter you use interfere or help you with what you're doing? Does it want to go where you're going, or does it want to fight you? And you think, well, I can swing the putter any way I can. But then I come back and I say, well, tell me about your grip pressure. Do you squeeze it pretty hard, or do you have a light grip? Well, I can tell you that 99 and the nine, you know, whatever percentage of cases, the ones that come back and tell me that they have a pretty firm grip on the putter are also the ones that have a putter that doesn't balance their stroke. Mm. And they just keep squeezing it tighter to control it. And so they buy, and I immediately know when you walk in, because if you've got one of those great big grips on, I know you've been struggling with it, and I know where to start the conversation. You know, it's not, you know, everybody gives me all this credit, but all it is look at it's what Arnold always told me to do. You know, look at the player, look at what they do. Is that what they really want to do, or would they be better off trying something else? And so, you know, why did Mr. Palmer swing the way he did? Because he had forearms the size of my legs. And so, you know, so he was going to hit it with his arms in his hands. And he was going to, and he wasn't going to put his arms in a position that had any extra movement. And he was just going to swing them back around his shoulders and hold the face square all the way through, and then just hit it as hard as he could. There you go.
Wow.
It's 8 majors or whatever it is, 7 majors and 80 wins or whatever it was. And it's as simple as that.
Wow.
Simple as that. And so for putting, it's the same way. So, like, for example, Fred, did Josh talk to you about, you know, are you a side under or side cover? Have you guys ever had that conversation yet?
No. I remember, no.
All right. So when you stand, and Mike and Terry, forgive me, this is not, but I can't do an assessment over. But when you stand naturally, when you just stand up and your arms hang naturally, do your knuckles face me? Do your knuckles face me, or does your palm face your hip, or are you palm out a little bit? No, so you're just kind of a neutral.
I'm standing up for you right now.
Yeah, I got it. And you're just basically neutral, right?
Right.
So for me, in putting, I don't have to move it. I don't have to worry about the things that the guys, the full swing guys do. But for a player that's neutral like that, that's where I'm going to start. Now, I'm going to put you through all the tests that they use for full swing to be sure. But I got a pretty good idea where I'm going when I start because of that. So what we want is, In your putting grip, then, we want your palm to be the face of the putter. And you're going to control the putter face with your palm, not with something else. That's going to control the face. Now, you can generate power however you want from there. But for sure, we're going to start with a neutral grip. Okay, now, so let's say you come to me, Fred, and you've got this big, great big grip on there because you thought you were using your hands too much. There it is.
Yeah. It's not my putter, but it's great.
Let's say Superstroke's a great grip, but you're using the 3.0 when you should be using a 1.0. Okay. That's a 2. Yeah. So
claw. Yeah.
I don't look at them too often, right? So so for you, we want one that's kind of that's not too big, because the bigger it gets, the more your right hand goes under the grip and you have a strong grip. Well, then when your arm wants to go to its natural orientation, the face closes and you hit pulls. So what's your miss tendency when you hit a putt?
Squeezing right by to the right.
You're missing it to the right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So can you grip that number two for me with your right hand and show me where your right hand is? You can just hold it up. You don't have to stand up.
When I'm putting?
Yeah, when you're putting.
I pretty much am like this.
Like neutral, right?
Yeah, yeah. Both hands side by side. And
okay, perfect. Then we wouldn't mess with that. And we'd start wondering why. So why does it go right? Well, the face is pointed right when I hit it. So why would the face be pointed right? It's probably a rotation thing, right?
I think it's the eye part you talked about earlier, yeah. Right eye dominant. I have a feeling that just starting to get that feeling that that could be part of my problem.
Yeah. So do you stand tall? Do you stand over it? Do you get your eyes over it? Does the ball?
I like a 33 inch center shafted putter and get in a, I stand over it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet you, to the podcast listeners, I just let everyone know that Bruce and I are looking at each other. So
yeah,
he's watching me.
I'm fitting him on the phone here, but So I think I know what it is. And so if you're right eye dominant and your eyes directly over it and you try and take it straight back, you get a counterclockwise rotation of your arms when you take it back to hold the face square to the target. You're shut now to the arc that you've created. You've twisted the putter to the left, and the only saving grace is to untwist like this and hit it to the right. Now, do you ever feel like your hands are going the opposite direction of your shoulders when you hit it?
Kind of a
reverse rotation?
No.
Right, going to the left?
And I'm really conscious, especially lately, of not breaking my wrists, keeping my wrists from doing that. With my lead hand bending with my lead
at 33 hand. Inches, how tall are you?
5'8", 5'9". I'm shrinking.
Yeah, so not beyond what I can do without seeing it. But there's something that's opening the face at impact. I don't think you come. I doubt that you come. I shouldn't say that. Where do you play the ball in your stance?
Just in front of the halfway point.
So under your left eye?
Yeah. Yeah. And for the listeners, he's thinking very hard.
Yeah, right I'm now. Sorry. I apologize. There's two things. One is if your rotation pattern, so let's say you did have the prayer kind of stroke or neutral palm stroke, and you open it, does the putter open when you take it back? Is it open and closed kind of? Swing on an arc?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah, you're twisting it shut. I was right the first time. Yeah.
Okay.
so that's a good example, though. That's a good example of how I would talk to anybody, Fred, even though I could be totally wrong on what you and I are talking about. But I think I think it's working shut to open somehow in the way that you move. And so we would just talk about that, and we would get you in a putter that maybe that would move a little easier so it wouldn't swing square to square. It's pretty tough to set up in a way that you swing the putter that it doesn't swing an arc and rotate. It's really tough. You got to get really over it. You got to get your shoulders over it. You've got to really get over it. And if you stand up at all, you get this shoulders rotating on one plane, putter moving on another plane, and that causes it to twist. Mm. And so we would just talk about that. And basically we would change. In your case, I know what it is. So where are your elbows? Where are your elbows? Are they sticking out? Are they pointed toward your hips?
I try to keep them straight. Let's see.
Your arms are pretty straight, aren't they?
Yeah, my arms are pretty straight. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it is. That's where it is. So you can't fold the elbow, and so instead of you going around your spine like this, you're going like this. I can see it now. Yeah. So you want a little more fold in the elbows, just a little more there, right there. And see if that, when next time you play, see if that doesn't cure the rest.
Yeah. Now do the elbows, do I have them? I hope on my microphone here.
Yeah, you are.
Am I keeping them open?
No, you're just going around your body. Yeah. You're just going back and through around your body. No,
okay.
Not a linear reference.
Yeah.
The guys that play with their hand on top, it's easier for them to have a linear stroke. Mm. It's easier because they just swing their right arm in a straight line, basically, or both arms in a straight line. But because yours are more to the side, then it's more of an around my spine kind of move, a little bit bigger arc, a little bit bigger, a flatter plane, whatever, however you want to describe it. But then, so for you, it's I'm pretty sure it's the twist. I'm pretty sure that what you showed me in that kind of locked out elbow, that when your shoulders move, it rotates your hands like this a little bit. Okay. And it's probably just enough, like you said, it wasn't big, so it's probably just enough that you don't feel it. And you just, right. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Left to right putts are no fun.
Correct.
Yeah.
I'd much rather have a right to left.
Yeah, so because of my launch window, technical term for hitting it to the right of where I'm aiming, but my launch window is to the right of where I think I'm going, so on right to left, so I just set it up there, and then I just bomb it out to the right of where I'm going, and it comes back pretty good. On the left, so I've got to overread the break, because if I don't, I don't get it started far enough left.
Yep.
And yep. So...
makes a lot of sense.
So you can play that way. If you know it, you can play that way, right?
Right.
If you know what your tendencies are, you can play that way. That's why it's worth going through just the process of understanding your stroke, just so you can figure out how you want to do it. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to do it my way at all. It's just that all my job is to tell you what you're doing and then say, do you want to fix it or do you want to get better at what you're doing? And you can be whatever you want to be. Like if you want to be back and straight through, we could reposition the hands and the arms so it wouldn't twist and you'd do fine. We don't have to overhaul it.
I'm on my way. I'm coming out.
And a little bend in the elbows and away we go, right? Just to match my shoulders up to what the putter's doing.
No, I'm on my way to come see you. Are you kidding? Now, if people want to take putting lessons from you and reach out to you, what's the easiest way to find you?
Yeah, the easiest way to find me is just Google me. My cell number is all over the internet. Okay. And you can just give me a call, and I do an online program, real simple, just some video, and we just start the conversation, and then I've got another program, and if you want to come see me and spend the time, then that's a whole other deal. But
okay,
I'm fielding calls every day. I just got one today. The guy asked me if I could make a recommendation of a player, and I said, well, why don't you just send me a teacher in Southern California. And before I'm going to recommend a guy, but before I did that, why don't you send me some videos so I know what's going on so I can tell him what's coming.
Yeah.
And so, it's just, I've got a network of guys now. So,
yeah. Isn't that amazing though, that people can send you on their phone, just boom, here, I just shot this and I'm going to send it to you. And
I teach more stuff online than I do live.
Sure.
All my tour guys are online. Wow. All the tour guys that I work with, we just do it online. What's the point of flying me out for a half hour to tell them to do this and then get back on the plane to come back?
Well, there's so many announcers now. We're working out of the studio.
That's right.
Instead of going to these live events.
The one player, he's got this really nice setup in his basement, and he just sets up the camera and we FaceTime, and I'm right there. Perfect. I see everything he's doing. It's perfect.
It's perfect. Yeah. Bruce, it was this was so much fun. This was so much.
We didn't fix anybody's putting stroke. That's disappointing. But yeah.
Well, what are you talking about? I'm right here. Yeah, hello. Well,
you'll call me and you'll tell me next time you try it.
Okay.
But yeah.
Thank you again. We'll absolutely do this again. I'm a sucker for stories, so we'll definitely do this again.
It was really fun. Thank you very much.
So as this show is being published, I'm actually on vacation down in Southern California right now to celebrate my birthday and spend some time with my kids and grandchildren. Hopefully there will be at least one round of golf in the LA area, but I gotta tell you, if you're not a member of a country club in Los Angeles, it's next to impossible to find a tee time without driving anywhere from 1 to 2 hours. And that's without traffic. Anyway, my son, a week in advance, at 6 a.m., he tried to book us a time at Rancho Park in the heart of Los Angeles, and the earliest he could get on the weekend, 7 days later, was 6:30 p.m. If you live down in L.A. and have some tricks on how to secure a tee time, please let me know. Maybe next time when I come down, we'll play together. Also, while I'm there, if it all works out, my other son is taking me on an adventure that I'll share on YouTube when it's safely completed. That's all I'm going to say about that for now. But coming up next week, On Golf Smarter, we'll speak with John Rahm's fitness coach, Spencer Tatum, telling stories of how he makes really good golfers into U.S. Open winners through his Tatum Human Performance Program. Follow at Golf Smarter on social media and subscribe to Golf Smarter TV on YouTube to hear our podcasts and watch unique golf videos. Golf Smarter is your podcast for caddy, and we graciously accept tips for services provided. Whatever you give and how often you give, trust me, your generosity is greatly appreciated. Just click on donate at golfsmarter.com.